Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Commissioner Mark Samulin, delighted to be with you today to have our Sustainability and Resiliency Committee. It is Wednesday, June 26th. I'm joined by my colleague, Commissioner John Alamon. My colleague, Commissioner Joy Malikoff, will be here very shortly. We also have Susie Torrienti, Betsy Wheaton. We've got Yanni and Michelle and Nick Kalergis from the City Attorney's office. We have a full agenda today. We're going to start with a review of our resiliency strategy work plan. As always, public comment is welcome. So on any item, if you want to be heard, just make your way up to the podium. We do limit folks to 2 minutes just so we can get out of here before the day ends. But obviously want to hear from everyone on these important issues. So with that, we'll start off with the review, and Susie, I'll bounce it over to you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, committee members. I'm really excited to be here today. Amy and I are going to give you an update of what we've been doing over the last few years. You know that we've taken the opportunity during this part of your committee meeting to update you on the work of Resilient 305 and the update of our strategic plan. I'm pleased to share with you that now our plan is complete. Each of you has a copy and it's online. It'll be going out this afternoon in an LTC. And we have also updated our own city strategic plan through the lens of resilience. This plan hasn't been updated in a few years. So what Amy and I are gonna do is just a brief overview of where we're at, what we've done, and where we're heading with these two planning documents. So there is a PowerPoint, if it can be popped up. We've aligned these two plans, the regional plan with our city plan. We really think it's going to help us prioritize our work products and the different projects that we have in line. It'll also keep us organized. I've already been talking to Judy, our grants manager, because it's plans like this that can actually help leverage and attract more funding, whether it's from foundations or obviously grant opportunities. It really helps us deliver services today while keeping an eye on the big picture. So just to go back real quick, the Greater Miami and the Beaches was that unique partnership, City of Miami, Miami Beach, and Miami-Dade County. We were chosen by 100 resilient cities to be this unique sort of experiment in intergovernmental collaboration. We've worked through the 100 resilient cities process and developed this plan. And the plan name is Resilient 305. And we do have a website for it as well. You may have heard that 100 Resilient Cities is ending. Their work really in terms of the planning efforts and working with the 100 City Network, that work is phasing out this summer, but the Rockefellers are still committed to resilience, and they have at least 3 pots of money identified thus far. There's going to be 2 offices inside Rockefeller Foundation itself. One is a climate resilience office. One is an economic development office for U.S. cities. So now that economic development is one of my departments, I'm actually looking forward to seeing what kind of opportunities we have there in terms of resilience, in terms of economics. And then there is a new entity that has been created in the Atlantic Council. The Rockefeller Foundation and Adrian Arsh Foundation have come together and created a new entity that's just getting its getting started. They're going to focus on these climate resilience issues, on migration and security as well, but they have named Miami-Dade as one of the first partners. So stay tuned for funding from those sources, hopefully soon. Just to show you how the plan, Resilient 305, is laid out, it has 3 broad vision category. It's places, people, and pathways. Places, it's really, think about all the reasons that we live in beautiful, vulnerable South Florida. And it's places is really about safeguarding those ecosystems. It's about the beaches. It's the dunes. It's the water quality issues surrounding Biscayne Bay. We're really going to be tackling the issues of water quality and Biscayne Bay as a region, not just a city. And we'll have a seat at the table talking about everything that we've been doing as a city. The people category of the plan is really, if you don't have resilient people and resilient families and neighborhoods and blocks and churches, then you really don't have a resilient city. So the action items in this area really focus on prosperity, jobs creation, education, health and safety, and making individuals themselves resilient. And then pathways, it's the connection between the two. How do we get there? How do we make sure that, that local governments have the right tools? There's interesting objectives here about how to pre-plan for after an event and sharing different resources. So all of those are the action items in the resilience strategy. It was released at the end of May, and just yesterday we had our first pivot meeting. We're calling the implementation pivot, because we really need to start thinking about the work that we do in our county a little differently. We have to really think about working beyond our borders and working more collaboratively from city to city. So the pivot is progress, innovation, and vision for tomorrow. It's going to start off slow with the folks who originally worked on the plan. This is what I call our weird family tree and the convoluted way that we work together. But essentially now, the pivot committee will be the three CROs. Then we're going to ask for a higher level person, probably a commissioner, to sit on the pivot with us as we start to implement all the different actions moving forward. So I will keep you posted, but we're really excited about our plan, and we think it really positions the county as a whole in a really good place. Amy's going to then share how we've aligned this work with our strategy and how we're aligning it with the budget as well.
Sure. Well, good afternoon. Amy Knowles, Deputy Resilience Officer, and I'm so excited to share this plan with you today. At its core, the strategic plan update is very much about looking at the Commission's goals that were identified at the October Goals Conference Retreat and really aligning our management objectives as well as the manager's actions as well, and to really look at the short-term delivery as well as that long-term, keeping our eye on that long-term regional resilience part as well. And in order for our services and projects to be delivered well and to achieve the most benefits, we know we have to be strategic and we have to think about that long-term vision. Our strategic plan hasn't been updated in quite a while. In 2015, the key intended outcomes were updated. In 2011, this was issued. So it's been quite a while, and we really felt that it was time and really a great opportunity. So we actually updated the Miami Beach vision as well, which was a commission goal, and we put together a team to do this. This is a long-term vision. The one that you might see around the city dates back to about 2005. It's a bit older, kind of much longer, and so again, we took the opportunity to update. So this is designed to be aspirational. It's designed to be future-oriented, challenging, and really is the culmination of all of our priorities. Visions, as you know, can range from being very long-winded to very succinct and exciting. So ours actually has five areas and little icons that you can see that are very unique to Miami Beach. And our plan is actually organized by these five areas so that we always maintain a focus on that longer-term vision. So we're leading with what's most important to the Commission and to our residents, which is prosperity. That contains arts, culture, education. Next, we have safety in our neighborhoods, and really that focuses on quality of life and maintaining our neighborhoods, our parks, for example. And then it leads into infrastructure and innovation, mobility, and our workforce. And really, that's the foundation for us to be able to deliver on that vision. So that's our exciting new vision with the tagline of Miami Beach being the city that evokes all senses. Now, the strategic plan is just putting a lot of structure around what we are doing already, but we tried to do it very simply. So it leads with the goals you identified, and then staff came up with management objectives that very much more support that. And then the next layer is departments and, you know, that budget and delivering those services. So that's the year-to-year implementation. And then Resilience 305 that Susie went over very much covers those more broad-reaching actions that we really need to have our eye on so that we can really benefit from that. In addition, in the actions, we have our city manager's performance contract items to make sure that all staff is focusing on those and delivering. So the strategic plan is through the lens of resilience. So we have the Resilience Rockefeller framework in front of you. And this was created a few years ago and has guided much of the resilience strategy development with our partners. The Miami-Dade County budget is actually organized by these resilience drivers as well. So we've worked carefully to make sure that our actions address these, and we've tied them to our own icons to kind of share that we are helping to achieve that. So overall, I'll give you a taste of each of the vision areas, but broadly, we've got 5 areas, 18 goals, 17 management objectives, 32 featured actions, and then 42 resilience actions. So in front of you have the full plan, but we did want to highlight some of the actions. So the prosperity area, which is kind of signified by the color purple here, had the most commission goals out of your conference. And its objectives very much build on the arts and culture strengths, balancing tourism with a quality of life, revitalization of many areas that you've pointed out, as well as supporting excellence in our schools. So the top actions we're working on in the city, you'll see here, everything from marketing our cultural assets down to 41st Street, Collins Park, the Fillmore, the Convention Center Hotel, Lincoln Road. So again, keeping our eye on all those main projects. The next area is neighborhoods. And the objectives here build resident satisfaction that are important to them. Very much focused on safety, focus on cleanliness, focus on parks, and modernizing our city codes. So some of the actions you can see, completing the fire station, working on crime, modernizing our codes. The RFQ was recently approved at the last commission, as well as several parks and actually creating a parks master plan. The next area is an environment and infrastructure. And these objectives actually protect and enhance our environment and invest in our infrastructure projects. Really looking to build resilience benefits, like reducing our flood risk. And some of the main items in here, of course, is our stormwater program, the Jacobs contract, our beaches, and much more with water quality as well.
I'll just wrap it up. The last two pieces are mobility. Of course, that's where we have our housing options, our mobility options. We're thinking about how are we going to implement the commission-approved transportation master plan, how are we going to invest in the beach walk and the bay walk. And then, of course, we end up and wrap up with the objectives really focusing on our workforce, having an innovative workforce. There's actions here about implementing program budgeting. We want to complete the GEO bond with the quick wins, conducting and convening new outreach, a lot of the conversation that we've had here. So all of that is in that kind of final bucket of really focusing on the internal operations of our city. And then really as we end the plan, bouncing forward is talking about what's next. We have a series of projects that are happening in our city day to day, every day. These plans now sort of wrap around it and put a little bit more structure and help us keep an eye on the big picture. What we need and where we're going next, and Amy and I working with John and Tamika in particular, is performance measures, indicators, data, and dashboards. And so we are working on creating dashboards for the different departments, dashboards for different important commission goal areas. For example, a dashboard on stormwater, a dashboard on North Beach, so that we can monitor what's actually happening, the legislation that's happened here, the work that we're doing, how it all's coming together. So we're going to put a little bit more structure around that. The ACMs will be meeting with their directors on a quarterly basis, providing this data. The data will be publicly available when we're ready. But it would be nice to have that continued conversation with the commission and these committees to talk about the kinds of things that continue to be important to you and to our residents, and that we can measure and discuss through the year and through the budget process in particular. So with that, that is our portion of the presentation. If you have any questions or comment, I'd welcome that. If not, I know that David and Roy are here to talk about their portion of the work plan.
Sounds great. Colleagues, any questions, comments?
Well, first of all, just our gratitude and compliments on behalf of the city for all of your work and the extended teams. Thank you to the 100 Resilient Cities and the Rockefeller Foundation, Columbia University, Harvard, all of the folks that helped contribute to this, and of course our Greater and Miami Being the Beaches partners with the county and the city of Miami. I look forward to reading the details of the deliverable. I'm glad you're working on the performance objectives. One initial thought is, in addition to identifying the objectives and the measurements that tell us if we're sticking to the plan, look for also the measurements that might show us that we are losing ground. Because resilience, in particular around climate change, we have our projections, and we're monitoring and trying to adapt at the right pace. That is something that we can afford and something that we can absorb, both from an infrastructure but also a cultural standpoint. But we need to monitor what that pace needs to be itself over time. Are we going too fast? Are we going too slow? And what would be the indicators, you know, on either side of that? So I would ask you, in addition to the, you know, the achievement of what this document calls for, what are the measures of the environment we're in, and are we keeping pace with that call to action that, as the leaders of the city, we're obligated to respond to?
And I just have congratulations. I mean, this is a wonderful document and strategy for the future. How are we going to publish this or promote this so that our residents and neighborhoods buy in and know what we're doing?
Absolutely. An LTC will be going out this afternoon. We're going to be posting this, of course, on our website. Resilient 305 has a website, also resilient305.com, I believe. And so that's at least one of the first ways of doing it. I wanted to bring it here first, since I had been giving the monthly updates to this committee. And we would like to also place this on the July 17th City Commission agenda so that the entire commission can adopt these two plans to help us move forward. The City of Miami has already adopted Resilient 305 for planning purposes, and Miami-Dade County will have it also in their July Board of County Commissioners agenda. So with your support, I would love to put it on the July 17th agenda.
That sounds excellent. One more question. I don't know whether you're discussing this as part of this or if it's another item with stormwater, and that is, are we using a 10-year rain event now? Is that the same as we had been using?
We've shifted to a 10-year rain event, and I know that David and Roy can explain that better, but yes, we have shifted to a 10-year.
Thank you. I'd like to know what the shift was and why. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'll just add my thanks and accolades. What wonderful work. It's wonderful that we collaborated with the county, big picture, working with other jurisdictions, and then translated it to our plan. My comments sort of align with my colleagues as well about data and monitoring. I think we should look for an occasion, at least quarterly, that you're engaging the commission on progress, whether it's at our goal conference or a workshop, just so we know how we're doing and you keep make this a living and breathing document. To that end, what I'd also like to do, if my colleagues are okay with this, there's some really interesting commentary in the environment and infrastructure, which is what we live and breathe. I'd like at our next meeting that we do a little deeper dive on that section, just walk through it, hear the words, get us to engage a little on that. I think that'd be a productive discussion. Great. Thank you very much. David?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and Commissioner. David Martinez, CIP. As usual, we have provided our report on the projects that have highly sustainable, resilient components as part of them. As you had asked, I'm just going to highlight some of the things, and obviously feel free to ask any other questions. Regarding the Indian Creek project, that project is still prepared to receive bids this Friday, June 28th. So we're crossing our fingers that we hopefully get a good return on that and are able to move forward with wrapping up that project. The Middle Beach Recreational Corridor, item number 5, also it's out to bid right now.
Can I ask you about the Indian Creek project? I have received a number of emails this week about the Indian Creek project from neighbors that just continue to be really frustrated by, you know, the lack of progress. And I know that you're still seeking, you know, approvals and results and all of that. Are there design questions that we're not in sync with the neighbors on, or is it just the timeline? You know, what I'm hearing is really the longing for the foliage back, the mangroves, and, you know, the natural elements that were there before. And I know that the installation of those is often at the end of the project. So what can you tell us about about that as far as the Indian Creek project goes.
I'll ask if Roy can help me out with this here, since right now Public Works got the lead on it, and then we'll take it once it goes into construction.
I mean, there's no way we'll ever be able to make people happy on the timeline of this one because of what happened. But maybe we can at least reassure them about what the end state is. Right?
Commissioner, if you will, I'll give you a little bit of summary of what we've done the last couple of months. David was a bit modest of all the efforts that the team's been through with the project management team, the design engineers, public works engineers. We held what was called industry meetings, where we invited each potential contractor prior to the solicitation going out to come in, where there wouldn't be a cone of silence, and discuss this project with us. We held about a dozen such meetings where we spent most of the day with the contractor going through all of the various elements of the project so they would be comfortable and familiar with expectations when they bid this job. So we spent about a month going through that. The solicitation did hit the street. Just to give you an example of the comparison of how we feel that this has been productive, the last time this project was bid, the total of contractors asked 88 verifying questions during the bid process. This time there were 12 questions. So we feel cautiously optimistic that the contractors have gotten comfortable with the complexity of the project and are prepared to bid. Now, we'll know that Friday for sure. That's when the bids will actually come in. This Friday, we will open the bids. Now, that's for the road project, and that is the one that's the critical path. That is approximately a two-year construction time once it's awarded. The other project, of course, is the seawall issue that we've talked many times about, and where that project currently sits is we have made application to all the regulatory agencies, the Federal Agency of the U.S. Corps of Engineers, the State Agency of South Florida Water Management District, and the local agency of Durham. We've made those applications with what we believed were meetings of the minds with their staff and our staff of what we would do, so we believe we submitted applications that should be approved. We have had regular interaction with Durham and South Florida Water Management District. The Corps has been a bit less engaged with us, but we, as recently as last week, we were all with Durham for an afternoon going through all the elements in hopes that in the near future we can get some authorization. Once we have authorization on the seawall, of course, we have a change order contract with the contractor to make those changes as approved by the regulatory agencies. And then assuming that the road project is underway at the same time, as the seawall is complete and the road in a particular segment, then that landscaping and the things you first questioned could then be installed.
If I could just pick up on that, then, Roy, and I believe we have some residents, so any residents want to be recognized on this. In terms of the landscaping, to Commissioner Alamon's point about design, do we have sufficient input from the community? Do we think what we're trying to get done from a landscaping is in alignment? Do we have issues related to that? Is it strictly timing? Or to my colleague's question, are there design issues we're still wrestling with on landscaping?
I believe there are still design issues.
Okay.
Our outside consultants are still making design recommendations. They haven't brought forth their final design. The issues boil down to there is one constituency group that wants heavy foliage. There is another constituency group that wanted continuous walkways and pathways through the area. Our design experts have shown us where we do not have sufficient space for a continuous shared-use path for bicycles and pedestrians, just simply because the space between the road and the seawall isn't sufficient for both. We've made that known to the various groups at public meetings that they've invited us to, and then the final position on some of them are, well, then they want pathways where we can have pathways. Some folks don't want any pathways. They're scared that it might create opportunities for bad behavior in those areas. We've submitted all of that input to our outside design consultants, and we're awaiting them to come back to us with their recommendation.
Okay. One last question, then, if, again, anyone from the public wants to be recognized on Indian Creek, now would be that moment. What are the next steps in timing in terms of the design consultant getting all that good input, doing something, and how will we bring that in a public way so the community can look at it and weigh in?
I believe our design consultant will bring forth their recommendation, and then it's simply going to be a matter of someone, either this committee, commission, or someone approving that, knowing there are likely going to be somebody in the constituencies that aren't going to be completely satisfied. From the input we've heard so far, the goals are not completely aligned.
I would be of the mind to have it brought to this committee so that we could sort of vet it, make sure the public is hearing, give a chance to cook, if you will, a little, and then bring something to the commission. That would be my thought. Commissioner Malakoff, do you want to weigh in on
a little bit?
One?
Just yeah. That what I'm hearing is two things. Put back the mangroves and do a walking path. And then I think that's going to more or less please many people, although there won't be a shared path with bicycles and pedestrians.
And the only walking path that I believe can be expected is a walking path that would exist where there happens to be sufficient width, and you might have a path down to the water or into some recreational area,
right.
But having one
very,
for the duration.
There's some very, very narrow areas.
Yes, and those areas just...
It's too close to the cars.
That's right.
Couldn't
exist.
I
so the question is do you want those paths or do you not? And I think that's where the divergence we're hearing at these meetings we have in neighborhoods. Some want those small, isolated areas where you can have paths, and some do not.
I would be fine with Commissioner Samuelin's recommendation for that to come back here. Whatever that meeting is, that public meeting where everyone can bring their thoughts, ideas, and opinions, and we can hash it out to some sort of resolution, that has to happen, and it needs to be understood that it's going to be final, because what happens, as you have well informed me over the years, is that we have a robust, well-attended public dialogue about something, and we never reach unanimity, right, of agreement. There, someone leaves that meeting dissatisfied. And then, lo and behold, on the next commission agenda the next month, we see that same item being asked by, you know, whoever the minority was to be then reconsidered.
Again,
and it's not
yes.
fair.
Again and again.
Again and again. It's not fair to the public who attended what was supposed to be the decisive meeting, and they arranged their lives to be there, and they participated fully, and they thought they left that meeting with an agreement that they could hang their hat on, only to find out that whoever didn't get their way, you know, found another way to bring it back up. We have to get out of that cycle because it results in excessive change orders. It, you know, it extends the timelines of the projects, you know, really just due to a lack of discipline, if nothing else. So we always want to hear from the public as much as possible, but we've got to find a way to listen to the public and yet still be decisive and close toll gates after we move through them. Both of those things have to happen.
Commissioner, we would be happy.
One question.
Just one second. Go ahead, Commissioner Malakoff.
No, respond to Commissioner Alamon first.
Okay, I was just going to say we would be happy to bring back the options to this body when the consultant is finished, and then ask this body to advise us and have this as the public forum, if you would like, and that could be that toll gate if you want.
I'm fine with that structure because we have the space. It's on the record. We have video. You know, versus a public meeting somewhere, and then maybe there's some confusion about, well, what was the agreement? So if we wanted to do it in chambers, particularly, you know, this is a tough project where we had a real problem. So maybe there's a certain threshold over which, you know, projects go through that. But I think this one probably warrants something like that.
Yeah, I would agree, and I would strongly echo my colleague's comments that, you know, the goal is to hear from all the stakeholders and then make decisions. And then we're not going to try and revisit all those decisions. That just isn't going to work. It's not fair to the city. It's not fair to the public. So let's make sure that when we're ready, we come. Let's make sure that we do sufficient outreach so folks know what's on the agenda, and then we'll look at options and then take it from here to the commission. Commissioner Malakoff?
One more question, and that has to do with the seawalls. Are we still looking to place living seawalls on the Indian Creek section?
Yes, but that's not part of this seawall project. There is a separate project that's being led by our environment sustainability group that are working on a living seawall area.
And this is a great opportunity to note, we're looking at a living shoreline that's actually going to be waterward of the seawall at the southern end of the project, and it's a separate project from what Public Works is doing. We're looking at planting red mangroves in this mangrove planter. We had a public meeting a few weeks ago that went very well. We got positive feedback from the community that attended, and we're now still going through that permitting process with the state government and the federal government. I want to note that the red mangroves, which are the typical mangroves that you see with the arms that go into the water, we are planting them in the mangrove planter. However, for the pathway, the mangroves that would be utilized would be black, white, or green mangroves, because they have different conditions for that tidally influenced, because the remainder of the section will not be tidally influenced, so we can't go with that red mangrove option.
Thank you.
Okay.
So as I understand it, and for the public to understand it, the applications that you've submitted that you feel that will get approved, that's really for the gray infrastructure, the hard version of the seawall. And then in addition to that, there will be a subsequent project to come in and install additional on the waterside mangroves. So if they don't see mangrove planters as part of that initial seawall, they shouldn't be concerned that it's not coming. It's two separate projects.
Yes.
And the mangrove project, the living shoreline, is at the southern end of the project, so it will be in the area where Indian Creek begins to widen there at 26th Street. So it's going to in that section, and so.
Okay, wonderful. David, what other projects do you want to highlight?
Sure, Commissioner. Update on the the Middle Beach Recreational Quarter. That's the boardwalk section of the beach walk. We're still geared for a July 8th receiving of bids and hopefully awarding it July 31st to get that project going as soon as possible. So there's no issues at this point.
David, the one just above it, who is RER? You're meeting with RER.
RER is the county environmental group. That reviews pretty much every one of our projects.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. North Beach Oceanside Park, I did want to have a little discussion on that. The project, although we have it out for bid, we're still waiting on a DEP state permit that has to come into play with that. Hopefully it should coincide with when the bids come in and all that, but I'll keep you updated. But what I really wanted to discuss is it's been a while that we've discussed the scope of this project. And probably a lot of folk have, forgotten what it was about and what we're doing. This is probably the largest project that we have in the city that's going to have some sort of, I'm going to call it impact, not necessarily bad, to the tree canopy, especially in the park. So what we did just this week, our staff presented to the READY team kind of a revisiting of the scope, mostly, concentrating on the trees. So the question I would propose to you is, would this committee be open to hearing that presentation the next meeting, so that once the project comes back to commission for award, hopefully around September or so, you've all gotten a little bit more up to speed. We've done some changes that I think, Commissioner Malkoff, I know how concerned you are about the trees. I think you'll be happy with. There's been a significant reduction in the number of trees that are being removed, mostly relocated in larger trees, and we wanted to walk you all through that and kind of bring back the conversation.
Yeah, may I?
Sure.
Not just that. I mean, you know how much we love our trees in Miami Beach, and so much so that the commission, we recently doubled the notice period on specimen trees so that the community would have time to understand if a tree does have to be removed, why that would be. Clearly, we're absolutely committed to growing the canopy. We have 5,000 new trees in the general obligation bond that will be installed over the next few years. So we're committed to the trees. But in this park, there are a number of old trees, and I'm concerned about if we have identified specimen, quality trees for removal, we need to give a lot of notice about that and explanation. So I'd like you all to think about that and maybe bring it back to this committee for discussion about how they can be tagged, how long those tags could, you know, be there, what they could say. For example, there's magnificent sea grapes in this park that are old, and you know how sea grapes, as they tend to grow old, are very artistic and beautiful. If we're removing any of those, we should expect, you know, some resistance. There needs to be a really good reason. So I would ask you to think about that. I think being very transparent about which ones and why, way, way, way in advance, will prevent problems down the road.
Absolutely. And we'll address all those points when we bring back the presentation at the next meeting.
Okay.
Good.
Okay. I'm going to jump to Brittany Bay Park. It's probably a park that you all haven't heard a lot of activity on. We've been working on this park now for quite a while, working through permitting and a lot of things. We're going to be issuing an LTC in the next week or so to kind of remind you all what we're doing there, because it's a significant project. However, the point I want to make about this project is that it's really a restoration of a park that was a little bit tired, I'm going to call it that. So it's a lot of replacing stuff that's already there, just like instead of the old lights, new lights, the pathways are pretty beaten up, new pathways, a new circuit, exercise equipment, some of the things. So it's not a, per se, brand new master planning of a park. So the park stays the same. The focal point of the park that is really should be we should focus on is that we are bringing in resilient and sustainable elements. We are bringing in a substantial living shoreline element with an overlook and some of those things. And we're going through that permitting. We're also trying very aggressively to obtain some additional funding from FIND, from Florida Inland Navigation District. So the LTC will show you some renderings and explain some of the things I'm talking about to kind of bring it back to life, because we're almost ready to put it out on the street, but we wanted to give you all the opportunity to take a look at that, and if you have any questions, we can clarify anything.
And I remember in this park that the number of overlooks was reduced. I think originally there were three, and now there's one. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And why was that?
From my understanding, the regulatory agencies were concerned, and Betsy, I can't remember if it was the Army Corps or the state, with the number of structures that would be over water based on what was found with the benthic surveys and the such. That's what I recall, Betsy.
Is Flavia here? Oh, she's yes, that's correct. When going through the permitting, Flavia on our team helped with that, with the environmental regulatory agencies. The final design was determined by what we would be allowed to get permitted and was within our budget.
Okay, can you include that in the LTC? Because some people will remember, you know, that there were multiples. The overlooks are what allow the residents to really interact with, hopefully in a positive way, the living shoreline and see, you know, the wildlife that live there, and that's their habitat and all the great things about it. And so I think they're going to miss the two that we were not able to get permitted. I think it should be called out in the LTC so everyone understands why that happened.
We'll do that. Jumping around, hopefully a quick update on what's happening at Palm and Hibiscus. Mm-hmm. We do have all three pump stations, all three permanent pump stations energized by FPNL. Finally, the last one on Hibiscus was energized this week. So right now the systems are running on what they're supposed to. However, of course, we're still working on the harmonization. Those designs are happening. We have had several meetings with DERM where we finally have come to just about at a conclusion of how we're going to address the permitting from the perspective of a private property versus a city. So I think we got through the hardship on that. We're just fine-tuning what that document's going to look like, but it has not stopped the data collection that we needed to do on the private properties, as well as starting to put together the individual mini designs that happen at each property. So I think we're very close. We're probably, I would suspect, we're less than 2 months away from actually beginning private property work. That's what I'm guesstimating based on the progress. Generators are in design. I believe they might have been already released to production. So we'll have, before the end of the year, we'll have three permanent generators, one at each pump station.
How many properties are taking advantage of the tie-in that we need to do this harmonization? How the really tricky ones?
I may not be able to answer it that way, but what I'll tell you is we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 70, somewhere in that neighborhood of properties that are impacted that would be eligible for what the city offers. We don't know yet how many of those 50 to 70 are going to be agreeable and sign off on the documentation that they need to sign off so that we can enter their property and do the work. We can certainly, when we start that process, we'll be keeping you up to date and give you some of the stats as we progress. And obviously, if we start running into some hardships, obviously we do expect some folk that just don't want anybody coming on their yard and doing anything, and then we'll have to address those in some form or another.
Okay. We all saw that interesting article from St. Pete of the little ranch home that a homeowner was able to get at least a partial FEMA grant to elevate. The homeowner in St. Pete, and I don't know the square footage of the first floor of that property, but it looked like a small ranch, was $217,000. They wouldn't reveal how much of that FEMA paid for. I understand those grants are hard to get in a process, but I know that the city manager and I talked about it right after that article came out. The city of Miami Beach has actually helped several property owners in Miami Beach apply for those FEMA grants to elevate their homes, and there is someone on staff with the city of Miami Beach that will help a property owner with that if that's their desired path. So I wanted to get that on the record as well. And my understanding from the city manager is that Miami Beach was going to work on a communications piece so that our residents could know that those grants exist, that we have someone to help them with that process, that that is an option if it makes sense for them.
Okay. Jumping around, quick update on the Venetian Islands, also related to Florida Power and Light. They have energized, there's two remaining pump stations that had not been put into operation. The South Rivo Alto one was just energized, I want to say at the end of last week, so we're preparing for starting that one up soon. The North Rivo Alto, the last one, my understanding is that FPNL did everything they had to do. They just have to install the meter and flip a switch somewhere. So hopefully within the next 2 weeks or less, all of the Venetians will be functional on six permanent pump stations. The road condition issue that we're all aware of, we're working on a new design of that repair. I expect it to take about 60 days more. The design involves obviously collecting more additional geotechnical data to do that. And then obviously we would, when we get there, I'm sure we're going to have an item where we either discuss it here or wherever, if you would like, at the full commission to walk through a lot of the nuances of contractor issues and all that to kind of bring that all together. So we're getting close. And as you know, or you might recall, we're also working in tandem with that repair an undergrounding, a franchise utility undergrounding effort for San Marino and Delito Islands that we've been working closely with the Neighborhood Association, and we've been making some progress. Okay. Again, just jumping around. Don't know if you, the West Avenue discussion you want to save for the City Commission, if that's the case. Other than that, again, I just picked some of the highlights. I'm available. Any questions on any other projects, obviously, that
colleagues,
you have.
Any questions or comments on any other projects?
I had one question. Number 12, the Venetian Islands, which you mentioned, it says that we're looking about the deficiencies of the asphalt roadway, which I've heard from residents about. My question is, as the work is being done by the various contractors, is there somebody from the city that inspects what they're doing?
Yes.
And if not, why not?
You're referring to the city project, And who inspects a city project?
Yeah, the city project on the Venetian Islands, the contractor was selected to do, this is particular one, has to do with construction deficiencies in the asphalt roadway.
Yes, we do. We do have a third party, or is actually representatives of the engineer of record that are on site full days inspecting this. It's got a very, and that's why I mentioned that once we figure out what the design is, how much it's going to cost, we're probably going to have a relatively lengthy discussion at, where, again, whether it's at this committee or at the full commission. There's a lot of nuances to this. There's a lot of, obviously, finger-pointing in different directions
between
engineers and contractors. The contractor obviously has a lot at stake here. I don't know what that – it's hard to put a dollar amount on it until we see what the repair is going to cost and what the repair is compared to what they were supposed to build. It's relatively
complex. But this was a design build, right? This was a design build.
It was not.
This
is one of the last projects that we did that was not design build. It was a standard invitation to bid, most responsive, responsible, qualified bidder.
Yeah.
It's a little different.
Yeah, this one's going to – take a lot of discussion.
It's probably going to be a little ugly, probably.
And my last question I asked before, and that's when was the change made to do a 10-year storm event, which is mentioned a couple of places, but number 15, the West Avenue.
I'll ask Roy CB recalls. I believe that was done through resolution at some point in time.
Commissioner, yes, one of the final actions of the Blue Ribbon Panel for Sea Level Rise was to recommend a change from a 5 to 10 year design. At that point, all of our jobs had been designed in 5 year, which included West Avenue and all the jobs we're speaking of, and only the new jobs going forward were to be designed 10 year, and then the designers were asked to give a price of what it would cost us to change West Avenue to a 10 year.
Thank you very much.
And the reason for that reso and that change, do you want to explain that? Because it in 2013 a 5 year condition looked pretty conservative, and by I think we did that reso last year, by 2018 it didn't look really conservative enough anymore in terms of the actual weather and tide conditions that we're seeing these days.
I think what happened was we experienced multiple extreme rain events that suggested to everyone that maybe these were going to continue at a higher frequency and we should consider a more robust system, and that's where the recommendation come from. I will point out that last year we didn't have multiple events, so whether it was an anomaly year the year before or not is hard to say, and I would strongly urge you to consider if maybe we want to ask one of our experts to relook at that and re-advise us to make sure that we didn't jump too quick, because there are very large cost implications going 5 to 10 year, and we either want to validate that decision or relook at it, because it's not as simple as a 5 or 10 year, because we have safety factors involved. There's a lot more to it than just 5 or just 10, and we may want to look at it all.
Has Jacobs Engineering weighed in yet?
We have not asked them that specific question. They certainly have the capability to weigh in and advise us on that if we want them to, but that's not part of their initial work order.
Well, that's interesting, because they are, I thought, relooking at all of our design criteria. Wasn't that what the task order said, or was it only the elevation and the base
The initial work order that we authorized them had three deliverables. A concept plan for blue and green infrastructure, road raising policy evaluation, and project size and sequencing.
Okay.
So that's what they've been authorized to do. Now, they have certainly submitted to us the willingness and the capability to answer any of these questions or weigh in. We've just been asking them very specific pieces of information and not large, broad studies. We've not asked for that.
I don't mind having them look at it as long as it does not... they're a very large firm, so hopefully they have plenty of resources to handle it on the same time frame as these initial three task orders.
I would think so, yes.
I would also be supportive. They seem to be the right group. Roy, I'm sensing from your comments that you think that would be a good idea for us to do a check and that the economic value and cost involved would warrant whatever consulting fee there would be to that.
It should be a relative small fee to make that analysis, and there are such huge dollar consequences to validate the decision or to advise otherwise. It could never be a bad idea.
It's a material factor in the cost of the projects, so
I
would move to write a change order with Jacobs to evaluate 5 versus 10 year goal in our DCP.
Commissioner, I wouldn't want you to think that I'm suggesting we're doing it wrong. I'm just suggesting that anything's worth a quick validation.
The idea
It's a very expensive change.
Yeah.
So we should have Jacobs Engineering that we're paying big bucks to evaluate it, I would think.
When we get to the end of the Jacobs work, we want to be able to look at each other
and feel
whatever that DCP is, we all believe in it. So if there's a question around this, let's close that.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman,
show that done by acclamation.
Amy's reminding me that we should probably make sure as part of this exercise to think about the community rating system, because the stormwater design criteria could affect the amount of money our residents pay in their flood insurance. So if it is more expensive, but it's better for your flood insurance, I think that should be part of the conversation.
Thank you,
that
Amy,
makes sense.
As amended.
Yep. Good. Thank you, Deb, for the project update. Roy, while we got you, we got a busy agenda, but anything sort of top line you want to share related to Jacobs or the water work that we have going?
Well, I'll give you a brief summary. We have had multiple meetings with Jacobs. We have had our kickoff meeting, where what we essentially did as staff was we went through with Jacobs the similar exercise we went through with ULI and shared with them all of the same information that we shared with ULI. Of course, they already had the ULI report, so they had that for the beginning. Jacobs has now scheduled site visits that begin in 2 weeks, where they are going to spend time in our community actually going to our project sites and seeing what we've done in the past and seeing what conditions are in unimproved areas to get themselves better informed, and then they will be scheduling community meetings for the concept plan of blue and green infrastructure. On the water and sewer side, a similar report from Hazen and Sawyer. They are our consultant that are preparing the hydraulic model for the water system and the sewer system. They're also preparing a comprehensive CIP plan for both. They have been engaged with us regularly and still anticipate delivery August, September of those plans to us. We have also connected them with Jacobs, so Jacobs would have their information of conditions of water and sewer systems for them to be able to make the recommendations on project sequence and take in those conditions into account as well. And so the experts at Jacobs and the experts at Hazen were familiar with each other, and it was an easy connection to make.
Good. That's good to hear. Unless there's any other comments, I think we're going to keep moving. Roy, thank you for the update. We have a few folks here for item number 8. So, I'm sorry.
I was going to speak on the Indian Creek project.
Okay. We would love to hear you. Go for it.
Make one question. Did you guys talk about the sunscreen issue yet?
Yeah, not yet, but it's coming right after these comments. No problem. We're getting there very quickly. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Madam Commissioner, I'm Steve Patterson. I live at 2901 Flamingo Drive, and I've been asked by the neighbors to come and speak and make sure that we're not forgotten. Had a pretty scripted presentation today, but after hearing this dialogue, I think I need to address some other things. Very encouraged to hear that staff is making good progress with their bid education process, with the bidding, with the South Florida Water Management District and DERM. Unfortunately, none of those three will get this job done. The gorilla in the room is the Army Corps of Engineers. And if you heard him earlier, he said they're not engaged. And I'll tell you why they're not engaged, because they're not in the business of compromise. I have a lot of experience with the Army Corps. It's a very difficult agency to work with. They manage thousands of cities across the United States and waters the bodies in those cities. They don't make it a practice to compromise. If they do, it's forced on them over and over again. The city is going to have to compromise on this permit application. The wall was built the way it was built because the city engineer said, "I don't build crooked walls." That was his quote in the Miami Herald. This wall is going to be crooked before the Army Corps of Engineers ever agrees to it. If they're not in dialogue right now, you're nowhere near getting that permit. This project has been sitting idle for a year and a half. It started 2.5 years ago. And we see no progress whatsoever with the permits. The bidding is a waste of time unless the bidders know what they're bidding, and the Army Corps has to dictate that. And that permit is only going to happen with political influence. That means that you're going to have to lobby your friends in Capitol Hill, particularly those involved in the committee that oversees the Army Corps, and encourage them to come out and actually see the project, give you solutions that they will live with. Compromise is not one of them. They don't five or 6 feet to them is a mile. It's a huge issue. The second issue that you brought up was the path. This is about a mile-long stretch. It has extremely narrow points, but more importantly than that, it has obstructions. It has about 14 obstructions in 4,000 feet. That's every city block. To build a walkway simply means somebody's going to walk for a block, they're going to exit off of this buffer, go down to the DOT right-of-way, come back up, and then walk to the next block. It's not possible. The DOT right-of-way provides for a bike path and a sidewalk. If you put a sidewalk in the buffer, there's no room to plant the buffer. We were promised at the Miami Golf Country Club at about, I guess, two and a half years ago, that this project would be the mangroves that were taken down, which the city engineer admitted he took down mangroves without a permit, even on private property, scraped the whole thing clean, and those would be replaced in phases from the south to the north as the seawall was completed. There's no room for additional pathways. Our backyards are almost unusable. It's turned into a campground for homeless people. My wife and I sat out there, and we were barked at by a guy who's acting like a mad dog on drugs. It's a mess. Our lives have been turned upside down for 2.5 years, and we're seeing no progress. These staff people, this is a Herculean effort to get this Army Corps permit. This is probably one of the biggest permits they'll issue, you know, in the country. I know I'm out of time. I want to just give you quickly an action plan. It's got 6 points. So I think, first of all, the City Commission, you have to own this process. You can't tell staff, go fix it. They can't do this on their own. They need help. They need consultants. They need political influence. And they need the power to compromise at extra expense to get the Army Corps' approval to do this. That's critical. Number two is the city needs to provide us with buffer plans like they said they would for our review. They said the plans aren't final yet. They've been working on this plan for a year. To provide us a preliminary plan to allow us to comment so when the final plans are done, everybody, there is a consensus. And we're ready, willing, and able to sit and review those quickly and give our comments the minute they're ready for us. We need to make a commitment, and I have to say, Commissioner Edelman, you hit the nail on the head. To constantly revisit the use of this space over and over again is costing you money and time. Mm-hmm. We have to make a commitment. There's a bike path on the beach that is second to none in the country. There's a bike path on the roadway, and there's a sidewalk on the roadway. We don't need another path. We need the buffer back that the city took down without permits. The next big problem is you've got to identify a funding source because you're over budget significantly. And that budget's going to grow as you accommodate the needs of the Army Corps of Engineers. We've got to find out how we're going to fund this project. And that's something that needs to happen now. We need to obtain these new permits. We need to move forward with the work expeditiously. And we need to phase it so that we don't wait for a mile-long stretch of road and seawall to be built while we wait for a buffer at the southern end. It was committed to us that it would be phased all along the way. So I just ask for you, you know, remember this project, when it first came, I stood up in front of this group, and I objected to moving forward without having all of the property secured and do this properly by the permit. And I didn't get laughed at, but I got totally ignored because the project started within weeks after me standing in front of you and saying, this is a bad idea. And there were commissioners that said, it sounds like a bad idea to me, and somehow staff moved forward with it anyway. So we got to own the problem, fix it, get it funded, and get this project built, because it's destroying our property values and making our lives miserable.
First off, thank you for coming, and absolutely agree. We've had some major challenges here. We want to hear from the community. We want to get it right, so I appreciate your comments. I'm going to make one comment as it relates to the buffer plans, and then, Roy, maybe you could address some of the other comments as it relates to the Army Corps. I absolutely want to hear from the community on that. I believe I speak for my colleagues. So whatever we could do when we have those designs to share with the folks in Indian Creek, any other stakeholders, give them sufficient time to digest so they can provide input in advance of the meeting, I think that absolutely would be helpful.
And the ones on Flamingo that look at it.
Right, right. Yeah, because I heard Roy articulate, I think, and maybe that's why you haven't seen a buffer design, is he's not sure which way to go because you've got
they need your direction.
The folks right. That are like, forget the path.
Right.
You have a sidewalk. You've got the beautiful beach walk. Why are you trying to create a third path where there ought to be foliage? Mm-hmm. And then I don't know who the stakeholders are that are asking for the path, but I'm sure they exist. And, you know, so do we have do we do two designs? Where are we? Is that the crux of it? Because we got to suss that out, right?
Commissioner, you're very close. The plan was in concept. Our designers met with the Mid-Beach Neighborhood Homeowners Association, and the Mid-Beach Neighborhood were the primary constituency that wanted this continuous shared-use path and had sort of challenged our designers to make it happen. And we went back to our engineers of record, our DOT representatives, to get the exact specifications to know what was allowable. And it took several months of that process to determine that there simply wasn't enough space to accommodate the request. We returned with that information back to that homeowners association, and then there was communication made there that there was some concerns about whether to have any path or not path, and the Mid-Beach Neighborhood Association wanted to be heard further on that as it moved along. So that's the point we are now, is asking our designers to come back with the information that the DOT provided for limitations and say, here's our recommendation of what's reasonable, and then it will be up for all stakeholders to then finally make a decision.
We met with Mid-Beach to see if there was some compromise that we could make, and bottom line is they want the bike traffic off the beach bike path. They don't care about a pedestrian way. They want a bike path, and there is not – I'm not talking about – feet, I'm talking about inches. There will be full obstructions in this buffer zone that will prevent you from moving north to south on it. It's simply, you can spend all the time and money on meetings. It's not going to happen. I gave you all a map the last time I was in front of you with photographs showing you the pinch points. And you simply can't walk or ride a bike or get through there.
Okay, it sounds like on that we have a process in place. We will hear it back at committee. We want to make sure everyone's aware of the process, and we will look to make a decision expeditiously and move forward. But the gentleman also raised some questions about the Army Corps and efforts to proceed. And I guess I want to, Roy, if you want to address those comments in anything you need from this body or the commission to address those comments.
Let me clarify a bit more of what I said earlier. Staff, prior to making application to the three regulatory agencies, met with all of the staffs of the regulatory agencies. We had multiple meetings with the Corps of Engineers, with South Florida Water Management and DERM. Some of those meetings were all regulatory agencies together. Some of them were on site. Some of them were in West Palm at the South Florida office. So all of the staffs acquiesced to our final solution. So when we had the acquiescence, including the Corps of Engineers staff, then we proposed what we all thought we had a meeting of the minds on, and then we were simply waiting on responses since we made the application for the permits. What I said to you earlier was we've had a lot of engagement since that permit application with DERM and with South Florida Water Management, but had not had engagement from the Corps. Mm-hmm. And then after I spoke to you, I got an email from our consultant. Ed Swaycon is our permit consultant, who said that the Corps had finally this week assigned the project to a project manager at the Corps, and then we could start engaging him. So we've not had that engagement, but we do have a person, a name now at the Corps that will be managing the project. Right now, we don't have a need from you.
Okay.
We may very soon as we're able to mm-hmm. have conversation with the person at the Corps making these decisions, if these decisions aren't consistent with what we've all thought are reasonable, we may have to come for you and ask for a higher level resolution.
I've had a project manager assigned from the Army Corps of Engineers on a project in West Palm Beach for a year and 2 months, and I don't have an approval yet. And it's not something that I installed and I want permission to have in place. It's something I want to do to go forward. They are very slow and arduous, and it does take, and I've had to engage political influence to get them to pay attention to the project, and it came from the mayor of City of West Palm Beach. And the mayor wrote a letter and said, this is an important project to us, and we need you to focus on this and make it a priority, and they are.
Very good. This is a priority. We absolutely want to do right. We've had some challenges here. It sounds like we now have a point of contact. Roy, you'll be fairly quick to holler if there's anything we can do, and if we need to bring something to the full commission, we definitely appreciate your comments, and we will be talking about this probably within at our next meeting, which is probably about 3 weeks away. So anything in the interim, let us know, but we will bring it back, and I appreciate your input.
Thank you. One final comment that should be made. The road project that we're opening bids on Friday does not have any connection to the core. That is a separate project. They're two standalone separate projects. The only connection they have is we need them both for the proper landscaping, but the lack of core activity does not slow down the road project.
So the bids that you refer to don't have anything to do with the seawall?
Nothing to do with the seawall. Strictly the road and drainage project, which is the critical path because we estimate that to be a two-year project and the seawall project to be less than 1 year.
Commissioner Lamont?
So by our next month's meeting, now that you've got the name of the project manager, by our next month meeting, you'll have reached out and had at least initial conversation and be able to read him a little bit. So why don't we touch base specifically on our agenda on this project? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have a good read, we certainly could ask for the mayor's chief of staff to be briefed and work towards, you know, if that kind of a mayoral letter was effective, you know, maybe we could work towards one of those and see if that helps.
The congresspeople that oversee Army Corps of Engineers can't dive in and get involved in a project unless they are contacted by an inflicted party, and it has to be somebody that's political, not a resident or a friend or something like that. So it has to come from like a mayor or commissioners or all of the above.
Right. Right. I mean, it could certainly come from all of us, but I think the key is, so why don't we do that? Why don't we see where you're at the next meeting? Mm-hmm. And then we'll know whether to engage the chief of staff from the mayor's office, you know, into something like that.
Thank you for your attention to the matter.
Thank you.
Can I ask for you to send to this committee whatever is the easiest to prepare, most lightweight depiction of what a bike path in that area would look like? Because I tend to agree that if that bike path is coming up and off and up and off and up and off of Indian Creek, no one's going to ride on it. And it's not going to serve its purpose. So that's not, they'll either just ride on Indian Creek or they'll get back over to the beach walk. In other words, if it's not ergonomic, it won't be used.
If it's dangerous, we shouldn't have it at all, number one. Number two, the new beach walk path is meant for bicycles and pedestrians.
Yes, it was designed that way.
And you might take comfort in knowing the design of the Indian Creek roadway includes a bike path, but it's part of the roadway. This request that I'm referencing is that the request was for a shared use path in that what we might call the landscaped area, and that's what's not has sufficient space. And the biking community has been very vocal to us. They do not want a lane there for traveling on a bicycle. They want to be on the same elevation as traffic, so if they need to turn on a street, they're not going up and down curbs to make turns and to ride. And so that's I think it's pretty clear to us now to have a shared use path in what we're calling the landscape area is not possible. The only question left is how much sidewalks or area will be placed in there perpendicular to Indian Creek that allows people access to the water, things of that nature is still to be determined. But I think it's clear to say to you there cannot be a shared use path. The DOT engineer of record has essentially said it will not be considered and would not be approved.
So I would echo Commissioner Alamon's request. To the extent there's a simple graphic that would sort of bring it to life, and if we've gotten to that conclusion, you're saying, Roy, at least preliminary, highlight for us what then is left. And maybe it's that you know, size issue that you said. But it sounds like we need to just make a decision here. We need to see this. And let's move quickly
you
so
bring
we
it
can
to us so we can be decisive. Proceed. And we can invite all the parties and we can talk about it. But without the benefit of the diagram, I'm in my mind right now imagining little stubs of walkway. That's not... I don't know why we would do that. I don't know why we would do that. That's not a continuous path. So it doesn't even meet what the request was.
Okay, so let's move forward on that, and let's try and lock that down. We'll be back at it next meeting, hopefully, on that one. Okay, we have some folks here for item number 8, an ordinance of the mayor, city commission. amending Chapter 46, creating article to be entitled Sale of Sunscreen, prohibit sale of sunscreen products containing oxybenzone, octoxinate, or both, providing for repeal, severability, codification, effective date. Let's start with a briefing from the administration, and particularly want to talk about sunscreen, but I think most importantly, the impact on coral reefs and what we do for our coral reefs.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Flavia Tagnoli, Sustainability Manager. This is an item that was sponsored by Commissioner Michael Gongora, brought to discussion for a commission meeting and then brought for SRC discussion. So before we dive into the sunscreen discussion, we'll have a brief presentation of the actual conditions of our reefs in our region and the main impacts threatening our reefs. So very happy that today we have here Joanna Walczak, Southeast Regional Administrator from the Office of Resiliency and Coastal Protection from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and also Manoj Shivlani, part-time professor at Rasmus, University of Miami, and researcher working with the South Cree Technical Advisory Committee for over 10 years. So they will be presenting.
Can I interrupt you? I see Dr. Zayak there, and I know that he came over from the hospital. So do we want to let him say what he needs to say and get back to the hospital?
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you. I mean, listen, I grew up on Miami Beach, Lenox Avenue. Changed a lot since I was born. I'm going to be 60. Those of you who know me, I'm an advocate of Miami Beach. I've been here my whole life. Nobody wants to protect our environment more, the Everglades, the oceans, everything. This is a multifactorial problem, and sunscreen has not been proven to be the main factor. There's just not enough data that's supportive to really say ban sunscreen. We know that the sun creates skin cancer, and people die of skin cancer. So what's the balance? Until we have data, I don't think this is a point that should be discussed to ban sunscreen. Some of the countries or states that, and cities that did it, they did it on a reactive basis, and it may be good for publicity, but I don't think it's facts. And until we have data that's supportive, that's reproducible, that can be accounted for on a scientific method, I think that there's no. I want to protect the reefs. I grew up and I've seen the reefs dying, but it's a lot of things, and you all know the factors, whether it be the heat, whether it be the phosphates from the fertilizer. But sunscreen, I think, is a maybe, but we don't have the facts. So how can we vote on something if there's no facts? That's all I have to say. I support these guys for doing the research. I think we need to save it, but I don't think that sunscreen is the answer. Anybody else have a question for me?
Thank you, Dr. Zayak.
All right.
Thank you for coming.
Can we just have your full name for the record?
Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, Neil, N-E-A-L, but nobody calls me Neil. Zayak, Z-A-I-A-C.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this opportunity. Again, my name is Joanna Walczak. I'm with the Department of Environmental Protection. I'm also the state's point of contact, appointed point of contact for all coral reef issues here in Southeast Florida. So I'm presenting on behalf of a bunch of us, and I know I have an abridged amount of time today, so I'm going to try to go through this pretty high level. But if you have any questions, please feel free to follow up. Ultimately, I just wanted to educate everyone on where the Florida Reef Tract is. So we actually have 330 nautical miles stretching from the Dry Tortugas all the way north to Martin County. And we have over a third of the state's population living in direct proximity here, especially in the Miami-Dade through Martin County communities. And because of that, we have to have a lot of different ways to manage our coral reefs. Most of you may have heard of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, the Biscayne National Park, things like that. I'd like to introduce you to the newly established Southeast Florida Coral Reef Ecosystem Conservation Area that was established last year by the state legislature. This specifically denotes that this area of the northern part of the Florida Reef Tract deserves attention and conservation, but it's important to note that it does not come with protection at this time. It is just a legal definition from our legislature saying that something needs to happen. So my job is to work with our community to understand what the stakeholders want to see there, and so we did a very large comprehensive process through the Southeast Florida Coral Reef Initiative, SEFCRI, of which Manoj has been a longtime member. I just wanted to bring that to your attention because this is an opportunity for all of us to be working together collaboratively on addressing conservation of our coral reefs here. Most folks know that our coral reefs are ecologically diverse. We've all heard that they're the rainforests of the sea. I want to let you know these are all photos taken here in Florida. This is not in the Great Barrier Reef. This is here. This is our backyard ecology. But what we don't talk about enough is that they are economically vital to South Florida. They're literally our first line of defense in coastal defense. They're the ones that are catching the energy of these storm waves that are coming day to day. In fact, they just did a really great model to show that the reefs from Miami-Dade County to Martin County actually are valued at over $6 million annually in protection of just shoreline. Add to that the value that they provide through commercial and recreational fishing habitat, our tourism industry, and the fact that they're a backyard medicine cabinet for biomedical exploration, not to mention our brand. This is literally our way of life. How do you put a value on the contributions to our economy? Unfortunately, they're globally threatened, and we've seen an increase in frequency and severity in extreme thermal events, both hot and cold water, that are stressing them out, as well as ocean and coastal acidification. But it's really compounded here in South Florida by the local stressors, those land-based sources of pollution, the stormwater, wastewater, coastal construction, beach nourishment, compounded by the 6 million people and residents and 38 million visitors. And unfortunately, just like humans, when you're stressed out and eating bad food and drinking bad water, you're gonna, if you get a little cut, you might get an infection or possibly even land in the hospital. And what we started to see, just like humans that are stressed out over time, our corals are very stressed out. And in 2014, starting here in Miami-Dade County, we saw an outbreak of coral disease expand, and it has continued to expand all the way through the northern reaches of the Florida Reef Tract, all the way down now, as of 2019, in Key West. What's important about this is that this is a disease that is literally eating the living tissue of the corals themselves. It's impacting more than half of the species of corals that we have. And I'm sorry about the projection issues here, but normal disease populations in any wildlife population is around 2 to 3%. In some of these coral species, we're seeing up to 66 to 100% of these animals being impacted. And it's incredibly fast moving. This is killing colonies that have grown over the course of a couple of decades, and it's killing them within a matter of weeks. It's also impacting our largest colonies. This was a 330-year-old coral that was found off of Broward County right by the Dania Pier, and it died within a matter of months. This coral was older than our country. That's how severe this event is. So we got all of our partners together across the state, federal, local entities, agencies, as well as all of the academics, basically everybody in the coral world, we brought them to the table and said, we need to work on this together. We have a collaborated multifocal response effort from figuring out where the disease is, what it's doing, figuring out what it is itself. And we got all of our technical experts together and got them to recommend, we really need to address the fundamental issues that allowed this system to get where it was. To get to where it is. So I'm zooming through these slides here, and so you can read them later. But we're looking at the water quality. As you know, that's a big priority for the department. We're doing in-water actions, the short term, but that's just triage. Unless we address these larger issues, the reducing the local stressors and restoring those environmental conditions, we will not be able to have resilient reefs here in Florida. And as you've seen from the economic numbers, I think they're worth protecting.
Wonderful. Thank you for that.
I'd just add that addressing local stressors is the most important thing we can do. We've done it for climate change at the local level. We can certainly do it for reefs. They're related. They need to be protected. Joanna mentioned $6 billion. $6 billion. And that study was done 17 years ago. These numbers are going to increase, and if they keep increasing and we don't protect our reefs, we will lose them. But the action needs to be local.
Can you please help outline for the group here the local stressors that are impacting our reefs from the research that you've done?
Sure, absolutely. So our department focuses, and the work we do with the stakeholders focuses on major groupings. But so we do with the fishing, diving, and other uses impacts, the coastal construction, land-based sources of pollution, as well as just the fact that most folks don't even know we have reefs here, and so literally everything they do may impact the reefs. But I'm actually going to go to Manoj for specifics.
I would say maybe about a third of the people down here know we have reefs. And the most important impact we have is land-based sources of pollution, by far.
And can you detail what those land-based sources of pollution
are? Sure, absolutely. I'll dive in here. So what we ultimately are looking for and recommending, and a lot of the other cities are adopting, are systematic removal of coastal septic systems, converting those to upgraded sewer. Big issues, very complex issues. Upgrading our actual sewer pipes themselves, those are aging out of the system, as well as ultimately shutting down the ocean outfalls that are comprehensively a part of that package. But we also need to be addressing stormwater, basically all of the things that we're doing for the bay, which is ultimately connected to our reefs.
I also want to note that through the Resilient 305 strategy that Susie and Amy presented earlier, one of the actions that's identified is build reef biodiversity and defenses and enhance our natural systems. Miami-Dade County is the lead on this action item. I'm going to be talking a little bit more on item number 3, I believe, on artificial reefs, but we have initiated conversations with Miami-Dade County to look at how we can approach this from a regional level. We also, through the Regional Climate Change Compact, the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact, have identified reef protection, reef preservation. So we will continue as the City of Miami Beach to connect into those networks as we're thinking about this from that more countywide and then regional wide scale.
I just add, I'm sorry, there's no one magic bullet here. You can't say that if you take care of this, the reefs will come back. They're stressed out completely, so there needs to be an integrated approach across the county itself, across the region, within the state, because there are multi-jurisdictional boundaries here at stake, so there's nothing one entity can do that will solve this problem. You may be able to put a Band-Aid on things, but you will find out very quickly that the reefs will continue to deteriorate, and then the question will be, well, why did you do this? If this is simply what you're going to do, it's not going to work because, as Joanna rightly pointed out, there are multiple stressors to the system.
Commissioner Malikoff.
You mentioned the city and the county and the state. You didn't say the world. And to me, the reason that the main reason that coral reefs are dying is because of climate change. The seas are warmer. They are stressing the corals, plus the warmer water allows certain pathogens to grow. And I also, since this is really about the use of certain sunscreens, there's very limited scientific data on the oxybenzone and oxinoxate concentrations in seawater and their impacts on corals. I don't think that that's a major stressor. I think the warm seas, and the city has done many things, but every city needs to do many things. Having buildings that meet LEED specifications to reduce the energy, to reduce the carbon emissions, to reduce the use of coal. I mean, there's so many things, and it's worldwide because our waters don't just come from the county. They right. come all through the world from Africa. We get the red dust all the way from Africa coming here, and we get currents from everywhere. So I think that we have to be very vigilant and do whatever we can and scientifically examine the pathogens to see if there's a like an antidote. But other than that, I think that it's very difficult. It's a very difficult problem, and it is worldwide.
Commissioner Alamon.
I'm looking at your diagram of local stressors. I mean, septic, we don't have any septic in Miami Beach. Thank goodness.
All sewers, many of which are being replaced.
Fantastic. Yeah, and we are in the process of replacing our sewer pipes. We've also eliminated certain chemicals from what the city uses. Mm-hmm. So we've been trying to take those steps, open to discussing what additional steps you would recommend. But one question I had is for the Southeast Florida Coral Reef Ecosystem Conservation Area, you said that it was more of a legal description. I mean, is there some sort of message of, to Tallahassee that we could send some sort of resolution or letter that we could send from the City of Miami Beach, you know, urging them to take a more proactive role in investing in our reefs and encouraging research, for example, among all our state universities or whatever it might be? What would you recommend we do to help the conversation along as far as the ECA.
Yeah, and if I could just piggyback, and I would welcome your thoughts, is there anything on a federal level that we could be advocating for as well?
Yes, thank you. So I'll address your question first. And this is me with my state hat on. I have to be very cautious about recommending anything for you to go to take to my leadership.
Uh-huh.
But I can tell you what my stakeholders are recommending. The number one recommendation over the 15 years that we've worked with folks in getting them to even this point is a comprehensive management plan that addresses all of the uses that are impacting the offshore area. So across, especially for this northern portion of the reef within the ECA, looking across those boundaries, across the counties. So we actually have all of the counties represented on the CEFCRI team. We also have a lot of the municipalities that have input along the way. But this is also about the users. And so it is the next step, and this is what the department is looking towards, is the next step is to figure out how to do that comprehensive management plan that actually has teeth in it. A management plan to the department is usually just a strategic plan. But what we ultimately will need is something that allows us to have authority to change the way we're doing business right now. So what I'm doing is doing a comprehensive review internally to see what authorities we have right now that we could put into place with current as is versus with a little tweaking versus a complete gap. And so we're in that review period right now for the state. In terms of the federal government, yep. We actually, again, I work on behalf of the state. I represent Florida for the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force, and we are working on the reauthorization of the Coral Reef Conservation Act of 2000. It is the only federal legislation that gives direct coral funding to all of us jurisdictional managers through the Federal Coral Reef Conservation Program. It was created in 2000 and never reauthorized and has had level funding since then of only $26 million. And that's for all of the 7 U.S. jurisdictions and 3 freely associated states of the nation.
That's great. So it sounds like there are some things at the state and federal level that we could get behind. I want to hear from the public. I know we've got some folks who've got some information to share, but I thank you for your comments.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate
for the opportunity.
It. I do want to invite our marketing and communications group. I think Jennifer might be here. Because we're talking about sort of interrelated topics. The idea is, what is the role of sunscreen? But we have strong consensus that we want to do right by our reefs. And so they're interrelated. And one interesting interrelated point is that the city of Miami Beach brands sunscreen. So we're in this game. So, Jennifer, if you could come up. Most importantly, talk a little bit about our current product line, where it's going vis-a-vis these two specific chemicals that we've discussed.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, commissioners. Jen Sawanis, marketing manager for the city. So I also head the licensing program for the city and manage the relationship with Destination Brands, which is our licensee. We have been in business with them since 2013. We currently have about 10 products on the market. Only 2 of them contain the oxybenzone. So there are 2 elements that they're looking at now, the oxybenzone and the octinoxate, mm-hmm. I hope I said that correctly.
Yeah.
The only one that we contain is the oxybenzone. And so Destination Brands, of their own volition, in early 2018, started the process of removing these ingredients of their own volition. So they've been in reformulation for almost a year now. After they reformulate, they'll be going through the standard FDA process. And they suspect that these products will hit shelves in January of 2019.
2020.
That would be
an effort to get there in
2020.
So when that happens,
yes.
we would not have either of these chemicals. And so
That's correct. The
extent there are any concerns specifically about the reef, and I know we're having a little debate about
mm-hmm,
that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is it fair to say that we might explore the opportunity to sort of position as being, you know, the reef-friendliest type of sunscreen? Is there something we might be able to do from a communication standpoint?
Certainly, and I think they would definitely be proponents of that. You know, they are very environmentally friendly. Since we started doing business with them, a portion of all proceeds goes back to environmental protection and education. So this is, you know, something that's very important to them. So certainly, if, you know, once it hits the product shelves, yes, it would be something they would advertise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One more question for these folks.
Yep.
The other stressors, you know, we talked about pollution. We talked about sunscreen, which is part of that pollution. But what about these other stressors? How, in our local area, that could be influenced by the city of Miami Beach, which of these other local stressors that you're pointing to are prevalent in our immediate proximity? For example, the lionfish, things like that. Are there other things that we could be doing besides just talking about sunscreen?
Sure, absolutely. And they are tough conversations, so I apologize in advance because it's a tough conversation. But beach nourishment is a very big one. Sand doesn't stay on the beach. And with corals literally within swimming distance of the beach in some instances, and especially here in Miami-Dade and Miami Beach, historically your coral reef was South Beach. That proximity does pose a challenge, but we've actually been working with the coastal construction industry specifically to find best management practices and integrating those into the coastal construction projects. But we can always do better on those. The lionfish are absolutely one, and just in general, and this is not the Department of Environmental Protection's purview, and so I don't want to speak out of turn to my colleagues at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. They manage the fisheries. But ensuring that we have the fish offshore on our reefs that need to be there in order to have a healthy coral reef, and vice versa. We want fish here to attract more fishermen. And you need the healthy corals in order to have the fish, because that's their habitat.
I was just noticing last month, was it West Palm or Fort Lauderdale? Someone held a lionfish tournament, mm-hmm. To go out there and catch them and get them out of the water. You can eat them, but Commissioner Malakoff, but I would be very careful doing so. They are toxic.
They look awful bony.
I'm sorry, could I just add something here?
Sure.
Even if you address serial overfishing, which is the taking of species after species, which is occurring down here in South Florida, not because of the commercial industry, but because of the recreational fishing industry, I should add, because that's where most of that effort comes from, it would still not address the area-wide issues that we face. And that's why I keep coming back to this, which is that whatever you do here, the water medium is dynamic. And I think this was pointed out. Just as an example, in terms of whether we want to be completely nihilistic about this, this month may be the warmest month ever in South Florida, in Miami-Dade County. We've been taking records at the University of Miami and getting these every day. And by the end of this month, we'll know whether, and it feels warmer, it's because it is warmer. So if we want to think about this as being, well, ultimately everything is climate change, yes, ultimately that will damage the resource to a point where we locally may not be able to do much about it. But if we can contain most of those local stressors using a regional approach, we might buy the reef enough time. And that's why whatever we do here needs to be done in concert with northern municipalities and southern municipalities, the state, non-governmental partners, as much as we can.
So sometimes in Miami Beach, what we'll do is we'll take the lead, okay, and then we'll transmit our leadership and our action to our neighbors. And often on many subjects, we'll find that there's a ripple effect. And so that's what I was trying to explore, is what are some concrete steps on some local stressors that are specific to our area that we could take that might then, have a ripple effect, rather than trying to have a bunch of meetings and getting everybody to agree and then doing it. We could just go ahead and do it, knowing that although we're very small and we might not move the needle from a scientific basis, from a leadership and community basis, we could move the needle. So that's where I was going with that.
Yeah, and I think some of the discussion, for example, we've had about pesticides and the role they play, I think, is front and center. I'd like to give the public, thank you again,
Absolutely.
I'd love to give the public an opportunity to comment before we sort of bring it up here and talk about some next steps. Would anyone like to be recognized on this issue?
Hi, my name is Jennifer Sachs, and I think you have a presentation, a PowerPoint that goes with it, or is that not going to be available?
There it is.
Not that one.
Okay.
It's one, it's blue, it says Eco-Safety Sciences in the bottom right corner.
I think it was shared with the agenda, Commissioner, because we had already set up for the presentation, so it's shared within the agenda.
Okay, it's in our agenda.
Yes.
On paper only.
Yeah, okay. Sounds it. So great. If you might want to top line
right.
it for
I'll
us, that would be helpful.
I'll try to do that. Thank you for giving me a little bit of time to talk. I'm here to talk to you from a scientific perspective. I'm an environmental risk assessor. I've been doing it for 20 years and was formerly a postdoctoral researcher with EPA. I have performed an environmental risk assessment for oxybenzone exposure to coral using all of the data that are available in the peer-reviewed literature. What I find from doing this analysis is that the data in the literature are not of sufficient quality to support a decision, a regulatory decision. So typically, you know, anything published in the literature has a certain bar to meet just to get published. But to use those data to support decision making requires kind of reaching a certain level of rigor above that. And in risk assessment, we have a method to decide how much weight should we put on a particular study for decision making. So I went through that process for the data in the literature, and they're not up to par in terms of their rigor. So I used it in the risk assessment to the extent possible, and even if adopting those data, find that the risk to coral is negligible, if any, because the concentrations measured of oxybenzone in seawater is very, very low, with the exception of one study, which I can talk to you about it in the presentation. You can see, like, mm-hmm. the source of some serious concerns with that. There may be some contamination in the samples or something. So as a result, I identified new studies that should be done to answer the question, because in my view, the studies that have been done are kind of, well, that's interesting. Maybe there's something here. Let's look at this more closely. So I'm involved in three new studies that are being conducted. One is a new toxicity study with oxybenzone and coral, and it is designed to meet the rigor requirements that would be helpful to make this kind of decision that you're considering. Another is a study on the exposure, so how much oxybenzone in a sunscreen might come off of skin after it's applied, because we need this to get a sense of, we can do monitoring to get a sense of how much, and then in some places where there's no monitoring, we can also say how many people are getting in the water, how much is coming off skin, mm-hmm. and that will help us understand the potential risk. And a third one is kind of a study to determine all, actually it's similar to what you're doing, it's to determine stressors in this region of the country, coral stressors, stressors to coral from all sources, and kind of where they fall in terms of importance. So that's what I'm here. And so anyone who has questions, you can contact me afterwards, because I know we have very little time.
Are you at the University of Maryland?
I'm not, no. But that is one of the researchers. I'm working with her on one of the studies.
Because more or less what you said was in this
her
research
piece.
Paper.
That's
that we
right.
Have.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else from the public want to comment?
Hi, Chair, Vice Chair, Commissioner, and members of the committee. So I just, I'm Kurt Reinertsen. I was here earlier this year when this came up before, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to come back to say, I'm happy that there's still some, you're considering this, again, from, taking on the scientific viewpoint, because, again, I wanted to say, as Joanna and as Dr. Sachs were mentioning, from the scientific viewpoint, there's still a number of gaps. And I wanted to throw out that, what we have seen, is that there's really just this one particular study that has not only got everybody, sort of the public, angry, but has also generated a number of interest from the scientific community. I heard the other day, so there's the Society for Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry meeting that happens once a year, the last one last year and last November. There was a session on UV filters. There were 8 submissions at that point. I just learned the other day from the organizers that the meeting that'll be this November, there's 21 submissions. So you can see that the science is, people are trying to do the science. Two of those submissions actually are coming from Dr. Piero Gardinali, who's a professor of chemistry, biochemistry, and the director of the Southeast Environmental Research Center here at FIU. I was actually at his lab yesterday. I was meeting with him to see, to understand some of the research that he's working on. I'm hoping that we can actually collaborate. He is an expert in this area of developing, you know, analytical methods for testing the compounds in the water. So we're looking at ways that we can sort of help get that to happen, because that takes a certain amount of resources. I was at the TAC meeting. Actually, I've spoke to Joanna many times. I'm hoping that there's ways that we can help with developing, you know, programs or other, you know, like other programs of study. We've talked about doing workshops. I've talked to researchers at Moat, Marine Labs, at, you know, also the DEP, NOVA, Southeastern University, and NOAA about, you know, like an actual workshops to look at this issue. I have a presentation from that TAC meeting that was actually one of their colleagues, the DEP Water Quality Standards Program Administrator, Daryl Joyner. You know, and I thought it was interesting because he did similar to what Dr. Sachs was mentioning, you know, and a look at the rigor of the studies out there. And he said that there's no toxicity available for corals and octinoxate in the literature. So the reason having that even included in these discussions is confusing to me. And also concluded that the DEP concluded there's insufficient literature data to develop water quality criteria. I'm happy to share this or email this. Just to wrap up, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm also participating in the studies that I'm working with Dr. Sachs as an intermediary to some of these studies. I'm trying to keep, you know, as an industry person, stay removed in some sense, but also I want to help this move along. I would love to work with the DEP. I would love to work with any organizations that you have here to understand what are the stressors and, you know, what are the ways that we can help. I certainly, as a parent, I consider myself an environmentalist. I'm a, you know, PhD biologist. The idea of doing anything to harm, you know, the environment is really something of great importance to me. So thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions or follow-ups.
Thank you. Dave.
I think we need to move on.
Yep. Yeah. We're about to. I think this is our last comment. Hi.
Thanks for continuing the conversation. Excuse me, I'm Dave Dobler, 800 West Avenue, Chair of the Sustainability Committee, the citizen-led. Thank you for continuing this conversation, because the reality is that our reefs are dying, and if nothing else, we're having a good conversation to figure out how we're going to address these problems. But this issue is not about sunscreen versus no sunscreen, right? This is really about specific chemicals in sunscreens that harm our ecosystem. We know that there are plenty of high-quality mineral-based sunscreens that are just as effective as chemical sunscreens. And I know this because I provide sunscreens for my cleanup volunteers. The chemical cosmetics industry has a financial motivation to keep selling these products. We know that fossil fuel companies have actively worked for decades to discredit climate change science, and tobacco companies lied for decades that tobacco causes cancer. So I have been advised, but cannot confirm, so this should be independently validated, that Professor Mitch Lamore's presentation in the agenda is actually funded by industry. So that's something that's a question you can ask, and if anybody has the answer, you know, by all means. But if you look in the theme, they're basically just trying to introduce FUD and discredit published science. But I don't see any evidence, them providing any evidence that oxybenzone is safe for corals. And I provided the contact information from the scientists who were involved with the Hawaii, Key West, and U.S. bands, but they were not invited to this meeting to present their findings and their research. What I will highlight is a statement in the professor's presentation stating, every chemical is toxic at some concentration. And proceeds by asking a very good question. Does the coral get exposed to UV filters at toxic concentrations? So, the Florida DEP website says that the benzones are compounds that are lethal to coral reproduction in very small amounts. So the DEP thinks that coral is being exposed to UV filters at toxic concentrations. Dr. Cheryl Woodley of NOAA has been compiling all the scientific literature, and the Mitch Lamore Prezzo claims that there's one study, but there are actually 12 studies that show oxybenzone disrupts the reproduction in coral and marine life. So she summarizes the predominance of scientific evidence indicates that oxybenzone is toxic to coral and threatens overall coral reef health by introducing coral reef, introducing coral bleaching, killing coral larva, and acts as an endocrine disruptor. The FDA recently proposed new regulations to make sunscreens more safe and effective. They state there is evidence that oxybenzone is absorbed through the skin and will appear in human breast milk, amniotic fluid, urine, and blood plasma. While the presence of something doesn't necessarily mean it causes harm, there have been animal studies that suggest it may have endocrine activity in the body. They continue, there is not enough evidence to deem them generally recognized as safe and effective. And once more data. The endocrine activity of concern to humans is exactly the reason why we don't want it anywhere near our corals. It stops their reproductive process. So yes, it is absolutely true that there are a lot of things that are causing our corals to die off at a massive amount, including dredging, beach renourishment, climate change, and other pollutants, some of these things we have control over. But it is really important to note that we cannot recover our corals if they're exposed to chemicals that inhibit their ability to reproduce. While I recognize that eliminating oxybenzone and octinoxate will not happen, mostly because of a coordinated effort by industry lobbyists, I do request our commission ask industry one very simple question. We know there are a lot of great mineral-based sunscreens on the market that are effective, that the consumers like, including from Johnson & Johnson. They make this stuff. So how do we get more of those products on store shelves and less of the chemical sunscreens, which are demonstrated to cause reproductive health in humans and marine life? And they're talking about the science, and this came from, this could be an easy eighth grade science project where they just take two corals in a tank and they add some oxybenzone and they see what happens. It's not that hard to figure out, and it's been well documented that we have a tremendous amount of sunscreen going into our waters. So that's my request, and I hope you guys will ask industry what we can do in order to get more of the good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Colleagues, I think we've heard some great testimony. Let's just bring it up here for comments in terms of where we want to go with this item.
I can tell you where I want to go. My brother died of melanoma. In Miami-Dade County, there were 1,559 deaths between 2011 and 2016, new cases, between 2011 and 2016, including several deaths. From the dermatologist who testified the last time this came up, including Dr. Zayak, from the other papers that we have that we don't really need to see the whole PowerPoint presentation, the oxybenzone and oxinoxate are not proven that they harm the corals. I know I understood what David said, but from the studies that have been quoted, others, there's nothing that says that that's what's causing it. Mm-hmm. It's the warming of the waters. It could be from septic tanks, a lot of different things. I don't think that this city should pass anything banning these sunscreens that are made because the dermatologists say this is the best protection you have from the sun to prevent skin cancer. So that's my opinion.
Thank you. Commissioner Alamon, do you have any comments?
So I'm looking at what Elizabeth Wheaton passed out, which was a proposed resolution supporting the reauthorization of the Coral Reef Conservation Act. So I wanted her to comment on this document that she passed mm-hmm. out. I think we should also... I'm happy to move it. I'm wondering about also the recommendation perhaps for a resolution urging the state to develop a comprehensive management plan with operational details as well for the ECA. That might be a good partner reso to this one. So if the committee agrees that we should do that, then I'll move that.
I'll second it.
I think those are good ideas, and if I may, I think what we've learned, and we've gotten some very fact-based testimony today from multiple perspectives. This is a complex integrated problem. We all want to do right by our reefs. I'm delighted to hear it's in our strategic plan. We're going to be working on this issue. Miami-Dade is taking the lead. So I think that we want to take this opportunity to do right, and I think those two ideas are good. I just would add a third. I think what's wonderful is that the City of Miami Beach own brand is an environmentally friendly one, and I would like to add to that concept that we direct the administration to capture this opportunity. For those who feel very strongly about this issue, mm-hmm. we're going to present them that reef-friendly option. So that was sort of the third element that I think would be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Good. Does their packaging indicate reef-friendly and some easy to understand?
At the moment, no, because we're not on shelf yet.
Okay.
So, and the existing product doesn't call that out. But so I can make the request.
Worth a suggestion so that folks can make the connection between the product that they're choosing and this concern.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to agree with Commissioner Malikoff. My grandfather died of melanoma. Dr. Zayak actually removed basal, which is one of 9 basal carcinomas that I've had.
Oh,
I had a squamous. So it's not like we're talking about eliminating products that are just, like a sugary soda, something that nobody needs.
Mm-hmm.
There are purposes for, for these products. And physical sunscreens, they're different. You can't get rid of the white sheen. So I think that the reason that there are chemical sunscreens is to encourage sunscreen use in circumstances where you can't have a white cakey sheen all over your skin, which is such as when you're on the dais at the commission meeting. Can't have that. Doesn't interact well with the lights. My point is to point out the practicalities of there's a purpose for these products being on the market, to encourage sunscreen use,
mm-hmm.
to to protect people's health and safety, and so we need to be very careful with the actions that we take here.
Mm-hmm. And the MB Sun Care products and the two that are now coming up without the oxybenzone, those new products will undergo the same FDA required testing. To ensure that their effectiveness meets the standards.
So I think where we're at is we can show it done by acclimation with the acceptance of my colleagues of
mm-hmm.
those three elements, the coral reef conservation at the federal level, comprehensive management plan at the state, and then, requesting the administration to pursue the communication of environmentally reef-friendly. I, for one, would be happy to sponsor. If my colleagues would, maybe we could all sort of sponsor this from this committee as next steps. Okay. Thank you. Next item, item 3, discussion on the City of Miami Beach stormwater, sanitary sewer, and water infrastructure best management practices.
Yes, I wanted to give just a quick update because we were here last month giving an update on this. We usually go quarterly. But we've had two big regional meetings that I wanted this body to be aware of. First, we have the NOAA's Marine Debris Reduction Workshop. It was a 2-day workshop in June where we participated both working on with a community action group to develop a plan for reducing marine debris, as well as on day 2, Margarita Karif, our assistant director, presented on our stormwater program and the efforts that we've taken as it relates to ongoing maintenance and data gathering. And that was a best management practice sharing opportunity where we were able to showcase how Miami Beach is a leader. Next, we had the Low Impact Development and Green Infrastructure Manual workshop that was hosted by the University of Florida. They're in the process of developing this manual, and the purpose of the workshop was to garner community feedback, and the city provided information on the success stories from our Living Shoreline projects, such as Muss Park, Brittany Bay Park, which is currently in development, as well as some of the grant-funded projects that we have ongoing, and our street tree master plan, which will be completed later this year.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions or comments on that? No, I think we're good. I'm going to jump around because there are a couple items I want to make sure that we cover. Commissioner Alamon has an item number let's see, I believe it is number 10, about a bioswale pilot, and it's also going to be coming to finance. I think that's something, I want to make sure that we cover that. So, Commissioner Alamon, do you want to introduce this?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, if you recall the difficult day, we had to make some tough decisions as a body regarding the rollout of our neighborhood improvements projects, and in particular, in particular, the North Bay Road, LaGorse area projects. And we had one homeowner stand at the podium and say he was 100% desperate. And the reason is, you know, he's regular intrusion problems onto his property today with no infrastructure improvement. I've been to his house several times. His garage door is rusty from, you know, it's just like at the bottom. Not the whole thing, just at the bottom because of that little section of North Bay Road around 59th Street, if you look at your LIDAR map, is one of the lowest, not in the city because that was really Palm and Hibiscus Island, Sunset Harbor and West Avenue. But definitely in the next tier, I would say, of one of the lowest along North Bay Road, which is pretty low elevation. So I would say about 9 months ago or whenever that was, Mr. Coley and I started talking about, well, what could we do? And at the same time, we had the Red Team Urban Land Institute recommendations coming out saying, you're doing a great job, but you ought to be doing more with blue and green infrastructure. And so I think for me, those needs collided. And I thought, you know, we could really do something special here. And I talked to Roy, and he agreed. We could actually pilot bioswales in a Miami Beach residential context. So what, you know, because you really just have swales. And if you're so lucky as to have a park near you, you know, that can be incorporated. But what would that look like? And how could it be aesthetically pleasing and appropriate in front of someone's single-family home? Because I think that's the direction that we're moving to, is so that we can capture that first inch and a half of dirty storm water and let it be, you know, treated, so to speak, by Mother Nature through the bioswale. So that was the easy part. That's the part I did. Roy, you tell them all the hard stuff that you did.
Thank you, Commissioner. We engaged with one of our engineering consultants and asked them to do a design of a bioswale pilot project at the location of 59th and Alton. The bioswale demonstration project included multiple types of bioswale, and the design that came in did come in with a predicted anticipated results of being able to manage the first inch and a half of rain, so therefore it would provide the pollution control that we've all been discussing. Because of it is a very low-lying elevation, hydraulically an inch and a half would be the limitation of how much water that bioswale could manage. That would take care of some nuisance standing water issues for the residents there, but it would not provide a solution overall for flooding. The overall flooding would not be solved by the bioswale and would still require comprehensive neighborhood improvements with pipes and pumps to move that water out of that low-lying elevation. So we have that design. It's in your package. I also have a board of it if anyone wanted to look at it that shows what it could look like. You also, we reached out to our green space manager and asked for them to identify if some trees could be in these bioswales. And so in your package, you have some different species of trees that have been identified appropriate for this location, elevation, soil type, proximity to water sort of thing. And bottom line is the designers estimated the cost of this to be at about $850,000 if we want to do it. The steps forward would be we would have to identify the funding and then actually put this out into a solicitation for bid and then see what the actual price is.
And the only part, Roy, if they look at the diagrams, your pilot, you would actually, you're proposing three different
technological approaches. So the pilot would actually include all three. It's not that we would pick one of the three. We would deploy different bioswale solutions in the three different swale areas so that over time, Public Works and CIP could evaluate the efficacy of the different types of bioswales that were implemented. And so to me, that's a benefit not just to this block, which obviously would be a benefit to this block, but it would also be a benefit to all of us. Because as we finish up the Jacobs work and we start to move into design criteria packages and ultimately issuing solicitations for future projects, we're going to be specifying bioswales as part of those. So this would allow us, if we can figure out the money side of it, which is more than I wish it was, will it allow us to see the performance of three different topologies of bioswale in a residential context. And I think that there's some goodness there.
It is, and there's one other component that I'd like to share is one of those bioswale demonstrations would take place in the easement and right-of-way that runs at the end of 59th Street to the water off of North Bay Road, and that is an area that was dedicated to the city a couple of years ago, and we have agreed to maintain access to the water for the neighborhood.
That's my question, because that 25 feet, I'm very familiar with that particular easement that was given to the city. It was complicated at the time, but nevertheless, that the public can walk to see the bay. If the bioswale is there, it will be beautiful. I mean, the trees and the landscaping, the iris, they just look beautiful. But will the public still be able to walk there, or are they going to be walking in water?
No, we would require the design of the bioswale to be such that pedestrians could still walk through there. There would not be space for vehicular traffic of any kind, but pedestrians could walk through
there.
That's
what was requested by the people who lived in that particular neighborhood. Was to be able, I mean, almost every street end is closed off with fences, houses, walls, and you want to see the sunset, which you can see from there, and you can't because there's everything in the way. This is one area where people could actually go and enjoy the bay and sunsets.
I totally agree.
I just didn't want the bioswale to be instead of a pedestrian path. But
it could
if they
be
go together, it works fine.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And those are exactly the sort of practical things we need to fit. For example, our first diagram, this Wade Trim diagram, I don't know what page that is. It looks like it could be on page 349. The very first thing I noticed in the initial rendering was, you know, there was no place to walk a dog. Mm-hmm. So those are just like simple practical mm-hmm. things that we have to learn about. So that when we actually start issuing projects in neighborhoods, that we specify them in a way that works for the humans that live there, right? And that includes their four-legged, you know, beloved friends. So I think this would be a great pilot to let us learn in a very defined scope. It would be 59th Street is just a two-block stretch if you took Alton to North Bay to the seawall. Very controlled scope that would allow us to have great learnings.
And I think that's the key word is learnings for me. I like this idea, and I appreciate my colleague bringing it forward. This is front and center to what the Urban Land Institute called out for blue and green infrastructure. We as a body have made a strong commitment to water quality. That is a top priority, and it's a very important priority of the community. So I like this and am supportive of it. I think it would be very important that we are very clear about the measures going in, how we're going to assess the three different bioswales. It worked, it didn't. What's that look like? I'd like to see that up front. And then clearly I'll put my finance hat on it. It's a big number.
We'll
work it. If there's options or opportunities, we can discuss that. But I am supportive of this. I sense my colleagues are, so we can show it done by acclimation, see it at finance.
For sure. And this one, it has to – really, I was very sad when I saw the number. I wanted it to be a heck of a lot less.
A lot of money.
It's a lot of money. So we need to figure that out, that there's enough, you know, benefit in learning to justify it. And the other question that I asked Roy is so this is a lot of money, and we're going to come some at some point in the future years, we're going to come back with a project. Like, how much of this gets invalidated? And so he didn't really give me an exact percentage, but do you want to comment on that, Roy? You know, there would have to be some adjustments. It's not that you would necessarily have to rip it all out, but there would have to be some adjustments.
I think certainly the portion of the project that goes from North Bay Road to the water could be standalone and survive a neighborhood improvement project. The portion that's along the road on 59th, it would be impacted. There would be some loss there. It's impossible to say how much at this point, but some of that work would be throwaway. But some of it will last beyond any project, especially that one portion on the city right-of-way.
So more, you know, more good stuff to think about, but.
Okay. Thank you very much. I see we have our CFO here, so I'm going to take that as a hint to go to item number 6, discussion regarding private seawalls.
Can we include in that last item, since the CFO is here, that when this goes back to commission, that there's some options for funding, or if there are, you know, what those options
Bioswale,
might be?
$850,000.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Good.
Okay, great. So I want to talk a little bit about the private seawall effort. This has been going on for a few months. We're taking a two-pronged approach where, one, we need to do a citywide assessment of private seawalls so we kind of get a sense for how big is this problem, what are the problematic areas today and in the future. We also need to look at public and private funding options, you know, because upgrading a seawall can be an expensive endeavor. So is there anything that the city can do there to assist or help private homeowners? So what we're trying to do is take both of those on, and hopefully the timing of both can converge over the next few months so that, you know, in a relatively short amount of time, we can start to chart some solutions here. So on the funding side, you know, ideally there would be some federal and state grants to help people with these costs. Unfortunately, at this point in time, there really aren't. And so one of the first things we looked at with help from Nick and the city attorney's office was really looking at an option like, well, what about a special assessment district? Let's look at that, right? And so we quickly realized that that was going to be pretty challenging, that that probably wasn't going to be the solution that we would land on. And I'll just touch on some of the reasons why that's the case. So first off, and Nick, feel free to jump in here if you want to, if I get anything wrong or if you want to just underscore anything. First off, seawall improvements tend to serve a private purpose versus a public purpose. So for instance, if we're undergrounding utilities and we're going to do a special assessment, that's for public purpose. This is more of a private purpose. And so that starts making everything more complicated quickly. So for instance, we would have to negotiate voluntary agreements with each individual property owner, since access to the private property would be necessary. So just think about the time and energy that might take to just meet with folks and go through all that process. There's going to be some folks who don't want to participate. How do you handle those folks? Are we going to force them or not force them? I don't think we can force them because it has to be voluntary in this case. We're going to take on a lot of construction risk if we're the project manager on behalf of individual property owners. You can imagine, you know, the punch list that comes with building a new house or something. Imagine how many things we're going to hear from a lot of residents about, oh, well, what about this? What about that? You displace something. So it can be very problematic. There'll be properties inland that are benefiting from these improvements. Should they get assessed some portion, a percentage, something? And as the CFO, the cost of all these projects, which could easily be tens of millions of dollars, would be on our books until the assessment is completely paid off. When we have small assessments, that's not really a big issue. If we had quite a few of these at any given time, it negatively affects our debt capacity and bond rating because it is on our books, even if it's kind of indirect. So the more we got into it, the more we realized that our role as the city would probably be best as a facilitator, where we're helping a property owner who's interested in upgrading their seawall obtain some private financing You know, hopefully in the future there'll be public financing from the from grants, but at this point, private financing and helping them find a good contractor. So we've had some informal talks with several banks about this, and we realized that other than traditional home equity loans and things like that, they don't really have this on their radar, if you will. So what we realized is that we need to kind of we need to get their attention and find out from them what would be attractive to them. What would it take for them to really want to be in this space? Because if you think about just the state of Florida and all the seawalls that are in the state, that sounds like a pretty good product line to me, potentially, right? So we talked about doing an RFI, and actually after we put this out, we landed on doing an invitation. Here, let's see, I have it somewhere. An invitation to industry review meeting. So that way, because we realized that if we had one big meeting, banks are going to want to go there and talk about their sort of products in front of other folks. So we're going to have more private type meetings. And also we realized that if we just say this is from the city of Miami Beach, how much attention is that really going to get? Not sure. So what we did was, with Susie's help, we're able to leverage our relationships with the other compact partners. So once you say, well, hey, you got four huge counties that are interested and over 100 cities that could camp onto this thing, we're hoping that that will help generate a lot of interest, and we'll see what comes back from that. And hopefully there'll be a role there that we can take where we're more facilitative. We put together a program. You know, this becomes more of a simple exercise if you're a private homeowner. So so that really from the funding perspective, that's really our next big step. And I think that that's almost ready to go out. Almost at this point, we just got our feedback from our partners because we had them review this thing before it goes out. So hopefully we'll hear something back in the next few weeks. And then from the, trying to get a citywide seawall assessment done, we looked at several different options. They're listed in the memo. And the one we really recommended was the drone LIDAR. That has a one-time cost of $93,000. Yeah. We would try to do that in-house. But it has it's attractive for at least three reasons. One, the drone LIDAR can be conducted without accessing private property.
That's definitely seems the best.
And provide the highest quality data. We know what we're trying to do with this today, but I suspect that there'll be a lot of uses for this data that maybe we can't even think of right at this point. So if we're going to go through this exercise, why not get the best data we can get? And it can be done the fastest. So for all three of those reasons, that's something we'd recommend. And given that it takes time, you know, as the CFO, I would recommend we try and do this mid-year. And because it is one time funds, I think we can try to come up with a way to get this done quickly. So then that way, as we're getting the results on the funding side over the next few months, and then we hopefully could get this inventory, this assessment going, we could then at some point converge and start to have a program, hopefully in the next 6 to 12 months for private homeowners. So we have, you know, this will be a phased approach. We'll as we get information, we'll probably have the folks start in known hotspots where it seems that we may have some issues, so then we quickly get our arms around those. And you know, is this sort of a district? Is it individuals? You know, we really don't have that kind of granular information that we need to craft an effective strategy. So those are some of the things we're taking into account. And something that may come out of this is at some point we might know, okay, today here's where the problems are. If sea level goes up X amount, here's the next tier. And if it goes up again, here's the next tier. And we might want to look at different things potentially, such as time frames. Like, okay, you're in tier B. You have X amount of time to address your seawall. And hopefully then we can show them, hey, here's a program to help you get there, right? So that's kind of the idea at this point.
Colleagues, questions, comments?
No, I agree. And the other reason behind the drone LIDAR that I support is it also gives, because we are obtaining those tools and those technology assets, we can also maintain the data on our own. So periodically, from time to time, we will be able to measure progress.
Can we move that we do the drone LIDAR?
Yeah. I'll second that, and also develop the RFI or whatever instrument you decided.
Yep, and I'm supportive as well. I appreciate the focus, the cross-department effort, and I especially like, John, some of your comments about known hotspots. I mean, as I think about this issue, it's a long-term issue. We want to get ahead, but it's a short-term issue where we have overtopping happening today.
Yep.
And so we need to be solution-focused, and if it's something like Fort Lauderdale did, we need to be on top of that in the short term because we know we have those issues. So,
well, for example, I mean, it's a great point that you make because, for example, we know of areas where the city has gone in and installed stormwater pumps and the private seawalls are not at all high enough and are being overlapped now. And so in a high tide, king tide event, our stormwater pumps are literally, you know, pumping the ocean. And so to me, that would be a high priority area. This whole adaptation process of a resilient 305 is a public and private partnership. The city of Miami Beach is never going to solve sea level rise adaptation all by itself. The private property owners have a role to play too, and that's one example.
Good example. Well done, and show it done by acclamation. Okay, let's go to item number four, because both of my colleagues are co-sponsors of turtle nesting. Who's going to present on this?
Yes, Yanni Pineda, our sustainability specialist, is going to give a presentation of an overview of our program to date. Back in February, we had a white paper that was sent to the executive director of the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and it is included in your packet. I want to highlight that some items from the white paper. We had requested that FWC, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, open a dialogue regarding five opportunities. Those five opportunities are: one, the potential of relocating nests in entertainment areas; opportunity two, installing protective mesh for nests similar to Broward County; opportunity three, install silt fencing around a portion of the nests to serve as a runway to help block a portion of the light; opportunity four, continue to pilot lighting improvements and provide flexibility such as seasonal lighting to meet the needs of all agencies, so both looking at how we can do lights that would be amber during season and then could shift to white during the off season; and then opportunity five, to get accurate data from the agencies so that we can work with our code enforcement and our police department so that they know the locations of nests and then they can direct their operations to those areas where we're seeing the most concern. We sent this letter, like I mentioned, back in March, and we did meet with the regional staff. We have not yet met with the executive director or their staff, so there is an opportunity to push this again to that upper level to encourage a meeting. We would love to host them down here so that they could see the issues that we're dealing with firsthand. So
is,
now I'm going to...
Is there anything we can do to get the executive director here or I mean, these all look like wonderful opportunities. How do we move forward?
I think we can extend yet another invitation through a letter, maybe from the mayor, and then ask our lobbying teams to also help us do like a field trip.
Yeah, why don't we have
we did offer that.
Why don't we have that letter come from the mayor and all the commissioners and the city manager and try to get them to come down here? Because I know that we've been a little bit frustrated because we see devices and techniques being used elsewhere in our very own state. And yet we can't get approval to, you know, or even like a really healthy dialogue about that. That's I just don't understand it. So I think we do need to kind of go up the chain a little bit and get you that access to be able to do that.
I would agree as well. I think these ideas make sense. So I think we're supportive of that action. Is there other feedback or actions you want from us today?
I you know, we can give a more detailed update in July. One of the things that the state has been working on is draft model ordinance language, which they are currently going through the approval processes internally. We were able to get a copy of that draft language, even though it has not been passed. And what we would recommend, if this body was interested, that we could come back with that draft language to you and a draft ordinance for recommendation recommendations, because there's definitely actions from the city's end that we can do in order to improve compliance.
Let's do it. It's been so long since we've updated our own ordinance, so please do come back with a draft.
All right. So I guess no presentations needed.
You're really
good
at presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next time.
So I am going to request that we defer a couple items here. We sort of hit our time. So my item 9, rainwater, it's something we can take to the next time.
That was a good item.
Item number 5 on artificial reefs, I think we can come back to that unless there's strong objection. And then I think we have some other items about plastic coming to the commission anyway. So I think we're going to hit there. So if and without objection here, I think we'd like to defer those three items.
Yes, and not because they're unimportant,
no,
but because they are very important, and we want to give them
right.
the proper time. I agree.
At 4, and we have to do other ones first.
Yep.
So unless there's any other questions or comments, we're done. Thank you for everyone's help.
Good job, Mr.
Good
Chair.
Thank you,
Dave. My apologies. I left that. Dave, do you want to give the 2-minute version, or do you want to do longer next time?
Like 60 seconds.
Okay, let's
not
do
even.
60 seconds.
Not seconds.
I'm not only here fighting industry.
For that. You were on my list, and
right.
I forgot.
And fantastic.
Sitting there the whole time.
Yep, just patiently waiting. Here you go. All right, thank you. This is just a quick update, and it is relevant to tonight's vote on the plastic straws.
Okay.
Yesterday, we reviewed the ordinance as proposed on the single-use plastic straws, and we unanimously voted to fully support the citywide elimination on the sale or use of single-use plastic beverage straws and single-use plastic stirrers. We recognize this is our next step to eliminate one of the most common plastic marine debris items. Plastic straws are actually number 5 on the most found items in Florida on shoreline cleanups and waterway cleanups.
Number 1, plastic bags?
No, cigarette butts. Number 2 is bottle caps. Number 4 is water bottles. What we actually found is that almost 50% of the top 10 items are plastic drink beverage containers.
Yeah. So the stirrers is very annoying, and you had a great stat in there about how many nanoseconds that stirrer is actually used. You know, it's such a waste.
Well, and these are actually really yes, and absolutely. And these are really problematic because our stormwater pollution controls are not as effective at cleaning these very narrow things as they are water bottles and aluminum cans. So this actually makes. It's not just a feel-good item. This is something that will prevent street litter from entering the bay.
And unlike plastic bottles, for which there's not really a good alternative right now, there are lots of alternatives for a plastic stirrer. There's bamboo. There's all, you know, many, many products that are readily available and not very expensive.
So what we're doing at the next meeting is we're actually having a workshop. We started yesterday, but we ran out of time, where we're going to be presenting a list of a wide range of options from you know, easy, obvious ones to, you know, if we wanted to get really aggressive on this, and just present you with a wide variety of options from the community that you may choose to take up or not choose to take up.
Dave, thanks for your continued leadership and service. It's greatly appreciated.
All right, thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
Where's our